welcome to the Takes of the Game podcast, part of the Vernacular Podcast Network. You can find us now if you're listening on the Third String podcast feed. Hope you checked out our fantasy football live draft last week with me and Eshawn and Zach Crippen, host of Third String. But as always, we've got Eshawn Nath on the other line. How's it going, man?
It's good. I'm ready to talk some basketball. One season just ended tonight and the other one's about a month away.
Yeah, so the WNBA Finals ended tonight, which we'll get into. But I do want to ask you, have you traded all of your Bulls memorabilia and gear in for Timberwolves memorabilia now that the Timberwolves are recreating the 2010-2011 Bulls with their signing of Luol Deng?
I did wear a Jimmy Butler Timberwolves jersey to the Bulls Timberwolves game last year.
Nice.
And it is true that the Timberwolves have, I would say, three of my five favorite Bulls of all time now, and Jimmy, Luol, and Taj. Nice. Kirk and Joakim are probably the other two.
So wait, is Derrick Rose still on the Timberwolves?
He is still on the Timberwolves. That's awesome. Kind of a bummer for me, because post-rape case, I'm not a Derrick Rose fan anymore.
I gotcha. It makes sense. I mean, if they sign Carlos Boozer and Nate Robinson, it's going to be a party. So,
yeah, I mean, we can talk about the Timberwolves maybe a little bit towards the end of the podcast, touch on it for a second. But I actually think that the Deng signing is like really good basketball move for them. And actually, other than the Rose signing, which surprisingly turned out better than I thought all the former Bulls players they've signed has like really helped them and it's been excellent basketball moves.
Last thing, and then we'll move on. But what's so interesting to me about when people like ridicule somebody like Derrick Rose on the Timberwolves is like, yeah, he's not good. And he's definitely not good for what we knew of Derrick Rose in the 2011 and 2012. But also, if he wasn't Derrick Rose, I don't think people would make fun of him. And he definitely wouldn't be this like punchline of a backup point guard. But I think just because he's Derrick Rose, people just constantly make fun of him and his gaffes and like, you know, different things that he does, where it's like, if he was just a random guy, I think he would be like, yeah, he's a okay backup point guard on like a team that's already flawed. Like, I don't think people would just be taking him to task all the time. So
I semi agree with that, in that I don't think other people would notice, but I definitely would be making fun of him even if he wasn't a famous name, just because when he was on the Cavs and Knicks, he legitimately was in competition for worst player in the NBA. He was a tunnel vision guard who couldn't shoot and put in zero effort on defense. The one thing about that, what really shocked me, which is why it shocked me that I didn't actually think he tanked the Timberwolves season towards the end of last year, because Tibbs had him playing D again. He was like playing really hard and actually pretty solid defense, which was very surprising to me.
Yeah. All right. Well, give us,
let's talk about the WNBA.
Yeah. Give us your recap. Sorry. So Seattle won the WNBA finals tonight, correct?
Yeah. So they swept the Mystics, the Washington Mystics, who were led by a hobbled Elena Deladon. It was honestly pretty heroic. Deladon came back incredibly fast from a bone bruise in her knee in the semifinals when it looked like she was probably going to be out for the season, and limped the Mystics into the finals. But really, like, this is very much like the NBA, where both semifinal series went, you know, just like Celtics-Cavs and Warriors-Rockets went to the deciding, in this case, fifth game, and it was up in the air in the fourth quarter. Mystics Dream on one side and the Storm and the Phoenix Mercury on the other side. So like really thrilling semifinals and a pretty anticlimactic finals, in the sense that the Storm swept the Mystics 3-0, and really only game two was close or in doubt for any part of the game. But I think there's just a lot of accolades that need to be given out here. I mean, for the Mystics, you know, they fought hard, but with Deladon hobbled and their second best player, Christy Tolliver, is really more of like a complimentary player. You should think of her like CJ McCollum, roughly, like a really good second best player on a team, but it just wasn't enough. But for the Storm, so, you know, there's their two superstars, Breanna Stewart and Sue Bird, and I want to get into their career accomplishments a bit in a second, but also like really great play from their role players. Natasha Howard had 19 in game one, 29 and 12 in game three. She's their big in the middle, and the Mystics just really didn't have an answer for her. And then Jewel Lloyd is kind of like a spark plug point guard-ish player, but I guess she plays off the ball because Bird's the point guard. She had a big game with 23 in game one. So a lot of weapons the Storm can throw at you. And even though Bird is 37, I believe, and is probably to the tail end of her career, that we really could be looking at the beginnings of a dynasty in Seattle. Seattle basketball deserves something to cheer about after, obviously, we know what happened to their men's basketball team. But let me just list some of these career accomplishments. I'll start with Bird. So this is her third WNBA title. She's got 4 EuroLeague titles, 4 Olympic gold medals, 5-time WNBA first team. She was named one of the 15 all-time greatest WNBA players back in 2011, so before a lot of these more recent accomplishments. She won 5 national championships in the Russian League in the offseason. So really, just a great capstone. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to force her to retire or speak too soon, but we'll see what happens after this, but a great finish to a career potentially for Sue Bird. And then on the other end of the spectrum, Breanna Stewart, we really got to talk about how this is potentially the best start to a career of any professional athlete that I can remember in my lifetime. So Stewart in college was the only player ever, male or female, to win 4 straight Final Four Most Outstanding Players. The UConn obviously won all 4 national championships when she was in college. And lest people think that she was only succeeding as the best player on those stacked UConn teams, she came right into the WNBA, won Rookie of the Year in 2016, was already all WNBA second team, so a top 10 player in the league right from the beginning. And actually, looking at the advanced stats, it's pretty wild. The Storm started playing like a title contender in Stewart's minutes right from the beginning. They had a net rating of plus 23 points per 100 possessions even in her rookie year. So she came in and like really immediately transformed that team. And here she is in her third season. She was the league MVP in the regular season. She's the finals most valuable player. She dropped 30 in the clincher tonight, had 22 in game one and 25 in game two. And don't forget, this is a 40-minute game, so you should multiply all these points by a little bit to get an NBA equivalent. Stewart shot over 50% from 3, and she's a big with a 7'1 wingspan, which, you know, that's huge for an NBA player in the WNBA. It's like out of control for a shooter with handles to be that size. Breanna Stewart is already, she's a 24-year-old WNBA champion, finals and regular season MVP. She already won everything you could possibly win in college and high school. We could be looking at a career that's shaping up to be one of the greatest of all time in any sport. So pretty exciting stuff, despite the somewhat anticlimactic finals in terms of close games.
Nice. Yeah, and I don't know if it stayed like this throughout the year, but I know like through the first month of the WNBA season, the ratings were up like 39% or something. And it just does seem like it's more a part of like the collective conversation. I think in a lot of ways, just like how you always talk about, people are basketball crazed right now, and it's good basketball at the time of year where there is no other basketball. So I guess if there was going to be one or two keys for the WNBA to keep riding this momentum, at like what could the league do to capitalize on it like over the next couple seasons?
I don't know. I mean, you and I have talked about how the teams in non-NBA cities we think are a great idea. Of course, we had one of those win the title this year, but I think we counted last time there's only 3 out of the 12 teams are in non-NBA cities. So
yeah, and I don't even think we were doing that on the podcast, because I was sort of making the I was making the comparison about just how, like, you know, what gets people excited. And I think you're right, because I know like the Silver Stars in San Antonio obviously were never very successful, besides, even though they had like a great player like Becky Hammon, and they moved to Las Vegas this year and have just been immensely popular. And it sort of reminds me of how like the MLS teams succeed. You know, they typically really succeed in sort of secondary markets like Portland or Kansas City or San Jose, places that maybe don't have, they're not necessarily like overrun sports towns, and then maybe like fail in markets where there's really established teams and cultures already. So I think if they can keep, you know, targeting these secondary markets, they would do really well. I think a WNBA team in Austin would probably do actually really well. I mean, Austin's getting an MLS team, so bring on the WNBA.
Or like you think about college sports, you think about like the Kansas and Kentucky basketball fans or like the Alabama and Oklahoma football fans versus, you know, teams where there's a professional team. And I think there's definitely some correlation there too in terms of craziness. Another thing that would be great is if they could get these WNBA finals games on not ESPN2 and ESPN News, although that's not the league's fault. That's ESPN.
Yeah. Do you think that 12 teams is a good number, or do you think it needs to be less? Do you think they need to expand? I know like maybe in the past they had a lot of problems with like teams going under. Obviously the Comets probably most infamously four-peated and then went on, you know, basically left town. But do you think they should expand, or I mean, is it a good number in it?
So I should say the caveat, I don't really have strong opinions on these matters. Like I watch the games and I think about the players. I don't really know a ton about marketing. But yeah, I mean, I think 12 is the right size because I think it's important to have some pretty concentrated talent when you're trying to get people to watch and have like a really high level of play. And then also with 12 teams, you know, most of the teams are in it for most of the season because there's 8 playoff spots, but they've really, I think, done an excellent job structuring it so that there's basically no team without something to play for, because the top 2 teams in the standings get a double. We've talked about this before on the podcast. The top 2 teams get a double bye. The next 2 teams get a single bye. And then the 4 remaining playoff teams are playing for home court advantage in the first round, which is like super important in a 1-game playoff. And so I think they've kind of hit the optimal strategy of number of teams and number of playoff teams while still giving everyone something to play for. So I don't really think there's a way to improve on that margin.
Yeah. We've never talked about this, but before we get into our longer topic, if you had to either take away 2 NBA teams or add 2 franchises, you couldn't stay at 30, what would you do?
Oh, I would definitely add.
Really?
Nice. Yeah, more basketball is always good.
I think I would take 2 teams away. Orlando and the Clippers, they're out of here.
That's interesting. Yeah.
All right. So we wanted to get into kind of before we start our season previews. You know, there have been a lot of strategy shifts in the NBA really in the past decade, but maybe even more so in the past few years. You know, you could look at basketball being played 2017-2018 season in the NBA, compare it to even what was being played in like 2010-2011 when the Miami Heat were formed and this super team era begun. And I really think the on-court product would look almost completely different. So we're going to talk about shifts in strategy. Eshaun's going to be our point guard. And then we're going to talk about maybe the next frontier and where we think strategy is headed. So you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I mean, it's wild because, you know, in the summer, I spent a lot of time watching these old NBA games on NBA TV. And like you were saying, it really is crazy how different basketball can look across the decades. So I was going to kind of set this up as like, I view it as sort of a 5-act play of like the back and forth between NBA offenses and defenses. And so kind of the prologue to this is in the early 2000s, there were some really important rule changes. 2 in particular were less hand checking allowed on the perimeter. So there's just a lot less contact that started to be allowed by defenders guarding ball handlers out away from the basket. And then the second one is they changed the illegal defense rules, which previously used to be that you could not be, you had to be guarding someone at all times. You couldn't be you couldn't be guarding a space. You had to be guarding a player. And so help defense was really different because you had to commit to leaving your guy and getting straight to the other guy. You couldn't be kind of in this no man's land that basically every NBA player occupies now and is one of the most important parts of the game. And so then the only remaining illegal defense rule is you had to be guarding a player in the paint. So now there's the defensive 3 seconds rule, and that replaced this old rule where you basically had to be guarding man-to-man or double teaming, like full-on double team, not just half double team or, you know, halfway in between 2 guys. So that was kind of what initially sparked the game to start to change. And that the first thing that drove was pick and rolls just became a lot more valuable relative to post-ups because with the new allowing these sort of these zone principles on defense with guys in between multiple players, it post entry feeds became a lot harder and helping out on the post became a lot easier. So you get, now you see in the NBA when guys post up, you have these guys dancing back and forth between the perimeter and the post player, bothering the post player and getting in their way of making moves while still not totally abandoning the shooter. And that wasn't allowed before. And then in addition, with these guys kind of in between players, in between the three-point line and the post entry feeds are a lot harder. And so the offensive started to move towards ball handlers who now, with the free movement and lack of hand checking, were able to move around a lot more quickly and a lot more freely on the perimeter. So it made post-ups harder, and it made ball handling on the perimeter easier. So teams started to move away from post-ups and towards the pick and roll was kind of the first big change. So, like, I feel like you probably have some experience. Can you trace some of the Spurs lineage through that change?
Yeah, I mean, I remember really when the Spurs offense transitioned, because they had, like, obviously the post-up centric of the late 90s and early 2000s when Robinson was still an offensive force. And then, you know, in the 2003 finals year, when they beat the Nets, and starting in the couple years after, as Parker and Ginobili emerged, they shifted towards more of a pick and roll centric offense. And I'll be honest, for a long time, I honestly didn't even really know like what they were doing. I just knew that that's how the Spurs scored, that it would just constantly be something where Tim Duncan would set a screen, and then he would end up open going towards the basket, or vice versa. Tim Duncan would be the ball handler and Manu Ginobili would have an open lane towards the basket. And Tim would constantly get those pick and pops like on the low block with his patented bank shot. And it was just kind of what I grew up with. So I was just so accustomed to it that I really felt like it wasn't until like NBA writing outside of local beat writing and podcasts became like pretty readily accessible in like 2007, 2008, and started listening to Bill Simmons a lot, that I was like, oh, pick and roll and pick and pops, that's what the Spurs like whole offense is built around. And I realize now that when their offense isn't succeeding is when they can take the pick and roll away from Tony Parker. So yeah, I mean, I definitely felt like in the mid-2000s, that's what their offense shifted towards. And I specifically remember it becoming more aesthetically pleasing after they shifted more towards that and more movement between those three, the big three, and away from just Tim Duncan getting the ball at 18 seconds on the low block and shooting a shot at like 6 or 7 seconds after he stared at someone for 10 seconds. So.
Totally. I mean, I feel like these old NBA games, even the ones that are great games, are like somewhat unwatchable for that reason. But it's wild if you think about, you know, the Spurs are one key example because they managed to evolve and be great in both eras. But you just think about the teams that were finalists in the 90s or title contenders in the 90s. And you had the Stockton Malone, which is a very pick and roll heavy team. But other than that, it was like the Bulls ran the triangle offense and they posted up with Jordan, but they were still posting up. And it was like the Olajuwon Rockets. Then it was the Shaq Lakers in the early 2000s and the Duncan and Robinson Spurs. And then you look at the teams after that, and it was like the Chauncey Rasheed pick and rolls on the Pistons. It was D Wade and his pick and rolls in 06. It was LeBron and his pick and rolls in the coming era after that. Rondo and Kevin Garnett on those Celtics. So it's just really, you could really see the shift pretty clearly.
I still remember, like, I feel like the most deadly pick and roll, and obviously it didn't last as long as maybe it seemed like it was going to at the time, but just from an offensive standpoint of it being truly unstoppable, I think the first time I truly like remember noticing it was with Nash and Amari on the Suns. And it, I mean, there's literally nothing you could do about it. Like, it was just all day long Nash and Amari. Like, you, I mean, he used to just torch the Spurs for like 45 points a game, and it was part of their strategy. I think they kind of let Amari run free sometimes to take away some of their three-point shooting. But like, I watched a lot of those Suns against other teams, and they were, I mean, their pick and roll game was just unstoppable. So,
yeah, for sure. So the pick and roll, pretty unstoppable for a while with great players. And then the next big thing that comes along is the defense responds. And the big response was basically engineered by Tom Thibodeau, actually before he was the Bulls coach, when he was the assistant on the Celtics. And what Tibbs really, like, his great fundamental insight was using the new rules to their fullest advantage. And so basically the Thibodeau defense on the pick and roll is you sink the big to concede the jump shot to the ball handler or the popper. And back in that era, that was basically conceding a lot of long twos and a lot of off the dribble mid-range kind of shots. And so that's the first thing, is you try to push everything towards the sideline. So you always hear Tibbs yelling ice, ice, ice in his hoarse voice on the sideline. And I forget exactly what that stands for, but it's basically trying to push the pick and roll towards the sideline and force a contested mid-range jumper. And then the second thing Tibbs did is sink the help side defenders on the opposite side of the court way further towards the ball side of the court and really overload the defense to one side of the court. And at first, it's actually kind of remarkable how successful this strategy was. There's basically like a 5-6 year stretch from the late like aughts, I guess we call them, to the early teens, where Tibbs teams were like the best defensive team every year, and it kind of didn't matter who was on the court. Like in Boston, he had some great defensive personnel, you know, obviously Garnett, Rondo, etc. And then Chicago, he had some great defensive personnel, Noah, Gibson, Butler, Dang, etc., Rose at his peak. But also, like, when those guys got hurt on the Bulls and they were trotting out, you know, Marco Bellinelli, Nate Robinson kind of lineups, they were still a dominant defense. And it was because for that period of time, NBA offenses had not figured out how to respond to the Thibodeau pick and roll D. It was like the big would sink, everyone would help over to that side, and these teams would just toss up mid-range bricks over and over and over, and Thibodeau would have the best defensive rating in the NBA.
Yeah,
that was kind of the next step.
I think I can't think of another coordinator, if you will, defensive coordinator, like assistant coach in basketball, that's had more of an influence. I mean, Tex Winter on the Bulls and influencing Phil Jackson in the triangle offense, like other than Tibbs on those Doc Rivers Celtics teams. I mean, I feel like you really can't think of another, at least I can't, of an assistant coach being so influential to a team's strategy and influencing a shift, you know, throughout the rest of the league. As much as Tibbs on those Boston teams did, because you see that in the NFL like all the time. I mean, coordinators are always like really influencing trends stylistically and strategy wise, almost sometimes more than head coaches. Like you think of so many different coordinators from recent history of like, you know, Rex Ryan to I just had another one in my head to, you know, Josh McDaniels. I mean, there's so many on the Belichick coaching tree where I feel like these assistants have had like these huge influences, where in basketball, that's a rarity. But I mean, Tibbs like literally influenced this whole strategy shift in the NBA from a coordinator assistant position, which is pretty remarkable because it's such a rarity in the sport.
Yeah, and in some sense, he was a victim of his own success, because eventually most of the league started defending pick and rolls the way Thibodeau originally was doing it, and then he had to figure out how to beat his own defense, and he was definitely not the first one to do that. And so then basically the response to this response was teams were like, okay, so the big's going to sink on the pick and roll, and they're going to concede the jumper off the dribble and the pick and pop, roughly concede it. And also they're going to help a lot off the weak side. And so this is basically where the three-point revolution came from. Like the Thibodeau defense, in some sense, was where the modern-day Warriors, Rockets, Celtics, whatever, were born. And so the responses were basically three things. It was off-the-dribble threes. So Curry, Lillard, and Harden, guys like that these days, or Kyle Lowry, are shooting threes off the dribble in the pick and roll. And then it's no longer when you're forcing the off the dribble jumper by the ball handler that it's like an inefficient long two. Then the second thing was big stretching their range out to the 3-point line. So now, you know, the entire league is filled with these Aldridge Porzingis types shooting threes on the pick and pop. And then the third thing is just playing as many shooters on the court at all times as possible. So this was really, you know, you can think of the Budenholzer Hawks that 2015 year, they were really good. The Spurs, LeBron, and all of his cross-court passes throughout his whole career, starting with those Heat. It's just basically like, if you have shooters on the weak side, you can't help off them too much. And so the response to the Thibodeau defense is basically shooters as pick and roll ball handlers, shooters as pick and roll poppers, and shooters on the weak side. So in some sense, the three-point shooting revolution is like weirdly coming out of the Thibodeau defense revolution.
So I remember in the, you know, early teens, 2011 was the exact season that the Spurs offense really shifted to a more ball movement motion offense away from more post-ups and just pick and roll with the big three. But then a lot of people were like, the Spurs have mastered Euro ball or European style basketball in the NBA. I mean, do you think like European style basketball with more motion inherently is a counter to the Tibbs style, or?
I don't know. I guess I haven't thought about the motion oriented offenses as much. Like certainly the Warriors run a ton of off ball action. Yeah. And I am kind of like, my narrative here is a little focused on what's going on the ball. I'm not too sure how off-ball stuff has evolved over the years.
And I guess like how I think of like these early teens Spurs is like, you know, they definitely did have a couple like specialists, like traditional 3-and-D guys, like Danny Green, you know, was sort of like adopted that, you know, Bruce Bowen mold and couldn't do much else. He could, you know, swing passes around, but he definitely wasn't good off the dribble. And then they had like, you know, your deep bench guys like Matt Bonner. But I think the way that I sort of see, you know, the Spurs adopting that Euro ball mode is that like almost on the offensive end, sort of taking up that positionless basketball mantle, just in that, you know, the two Spurs teams that made the finals in the teens, kind of everybody could do a little bit of everything. And, you know, you had great passing from your big men with Duncan, Diaw, Splitter. And then you had guys like Leonard who could run the point guard position sometimes. Obviously, Manu was traditionally a two, but could play the point. So you just had sort of everyone wearing all these sorts of different hats where, you know, I've really noticed as I've watched 90s basketball and early 2000s, and even in the old Spurs, it was like people were 100% like, kind of defined to their specific roles. And I feel like this decade we've seen that shift towards positionless basketball. I think people a lot of times associate that with switching, but I mean, I think it really started on the offensive end. And the reason that switching, and I know you're going to get into that in a second when you talk about how the Warriors have changed the basketball, but you know, switching was almost a response to offensive players being able to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And it's like, obviously with all these things, it's like back and forth and what's causing what. But do you remember that this was a conference semifinals between the Warriors and the Grizzlies like 4 years ago when Steve Kerr just aggressively abandoned Tony Allen and had Boga quote unquote guard him by actually just standing 20 feet away from him and daring him to score?
Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, I do. I mean, that was 2015, the first Warriors championship, right?
I feel like that was kind of, I mean, obviously teams have employed some version of that strategy to some degree for a long time, but I feel like that was kind of the moment where someone took it to its logical conclusion and you realize that like, man, like guys like Tony Allen and Roberson, like you really have to scheme around them aggressively and have four other guys who can really score on the court, or they're just going to be unplayable in the playoffs.
Yeah, and I feel like in the past couple of years that those situations have really arisen way more so than when I was watching, you know, the 2000s basketball. Because, you know, I would remember like NBA has always been based on matchups to a certain extent, and there would be guys who'd play less in certain series and more in others. And a lot of times that would center around big men. Like there'd be some series where your third or fourth big man wouldn't get as many minutes if the other team wasn't as big. But until the past couple of years, I don't feel like there have been situations where it's like guys are truly unplayable. Like you think of last year, Enes Kanter, who's a great offensive big man, like against the Rockets when he was still on the Thunder. Like, he literally could not be on the court because he was such a liability. And I don't think, like, until recently, good players like that wouldn't just not have a place on the court, which is really interesting. So.
Totally. I want to get to this more in a second when we talk about where we think that things are going next. But so then basically the act five of this play that we're kind of part of the way into is that in response to all the shooting everywhere on the court, basically the thing the shooting creates is you don't have time to recover. So you can't play, well, you can, and some teams still are, but it's harder to play this sink and recover, help and recover kind of defense on the pick and roll, because there's always going to be a split second where somebody's got to look at a three. And so, you know, the Spurs, the Timberwolves, the Bulls, some of these teams are still playing not switch everything, but a few of the teams, and disproportionately the really athletic, really successful teams like the Warriors, Celtics, 2013-14 Heat, the Raptors a little bit here and there, the Rockets certainly really pretty intensely towards the end of last season, are going to the switch everything. And there, basically the way the offense has responded to switch everything is they aggressively try to get an ISO against the worst defender on the court. So last year, this is pretty much the playoffs. The conference finals kind of devolved into LeBron running three pick and rolls in a row until he could get Rozier switched onto him. Tatum running pick and rolls over and over against the Cavs until he could get Calderon or Korver switched onto him. Harden running pick and rolls over and over against the Warriors until he could get Steph switched onto him. Although, funnily enough, the Rockets did terribly ISOing against Steph in that series. Which, of course, I would say that being a Steph fan. And so, yeah, that's kind of the yin has been some teams trying to go to switch everything, and the yang has been, all right, well, if you're going to switch everything, we're going to get our best guy on your worst guy and just play one-on-one for 48 minutes. And that's kind of where we are right now, is that's, you know, it's kind of a mix of whether teams are doing the switch everything or not. But that's kind of how the switch everything has been treated.
And so what do you think, like, wins out over the next couple of years? Positionless basketball, more of the beautiful game in the Spurs and Warriors mold, or the Rockets, like, kind of death by isolation basketball?
Man, I don't know. I think it's going to depend a lot on what wins out on the defensive side. I think more and more, so this is kind of one of the, I listed some questions here of, like, so one question is just how much longer can guys with a really gaping hole in their offensive game last in the league? Like, will non-shooting guards like Lonzo and Rondo be playable in the NBA that much longer? If they're, I mean, I guess like off the ball, maybe. I don't know. These are questions. Will traditional bigs ever recover? I feel like the traditional bigs now are moving more and more towards, can you do the Clint Capella thing of finish the lobs in the pick and roll and switch on defense on the perimeter and protect the rim? Or if not, you're just kind of like a 5-minute bench guy like Al Jefferson, who is like a borderline all-star.
And so I was going to ask that. So by traditional bigs, do you mean, is there a place in the NBA for the Al Jeffersons or the Greg Monroes? Or are you saying, like, do the Shaqs and the Duncans have a place in the league?
Yeah, I mean, I guess Shaq and Duncan are just like much better versions of Al Jefferson and Greg Monroe, right? Like, what about DeAndre Ayton? Like, I guess which he's kind of in between, right? He's finishing on the pick and rolls, but also he can't really switch on the perimeter. His rim protection's questionable, and he posted up a ton at Arizona. So I don't know. It feels like DeAndre Ayton's got to go more of the Capella route to be successful.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is it always almost just takes like one player. Because, you know, Curry, look at the influence he's had over the shift in style and strategy, and how there are so many people now trying to emulate Curry's game, a lot of times unsuccessfully. But if I think it's like if one big man can really come in and exploit this, then you'll probably see a shift back. And there's like, you know, your five acts, like there's always a response to something. So if a highly skilled offensive big man is able to come in and just dominate the fact that he has, you know, mostly 6'7 and 6'8 guys guarding him, then I think you'll see sort of a reevaluation where people like, oh, well, maybe we do need some traditional fives. But I think it'll just be really interesting to see if guys like Joel Embiid, who have more well-rounded skill sets, are they able to be a superstar in today's game like they maybe could have been 8 years ago even? Like,
yeah.
I mean, Joel Embiid probably, if he's in the league from 2007 to 2011, he has a pretty inside track to, you know, barring he stays healthy, he has a pretty inside track to becoming the league's best player. And now totally. I'm like, you know, maybe he could be top three, top four in certain seasons, but I would say he's probably going to be in that 5 to 12 range with just the current way that the NBA is structured.
Well, he is, and I should mention that I wasn't trying to make it sound like the Switch Everything teams are definitely doing better overall, because like Embiid, his defensive rating has been off the charts. Like, they are so good on defense when he's on the court every year, and we know the Jazz had like a spectacular defense with Gobert on the court last year, and obviously Embiid and Gobert are not switching on the perimeter. They're the sink and protect the rim kind of bigs.
Yeah.
So Embiid is a superstar in defense already, but yeah, on offense, it almost feels like the response to Switch Everything might be a type of hybrid where you have a dominant post player, and instead of trying to get a switch where you're getting Harden on someone or LeBron on someone to blow by them on the perimeter, you're trying to get a switch with, like, picture like a DeMarcus Cousins like bully in the post. But it seems like to enable that, you need to surround that player with a bunch of shooters still, because yeah, otherwise you can't get the post feed down there.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you force the switch and you can't get the post feed, then it doesn't do you any good. But yeah, I think attacking switches has to involve post-ups, like, necessarily. Like, as long as guys like, you know, Steph and Trae Young and Damian Lillard and whoever the other tiny point guards, as long as those guys are in the league, it seems like exploiting their lack of size has got to become at least as much of a strategy as exploiting, you know, Embiid's lack of perimeter quickness or whatever.
Yeah. What's sad to me, and I know we've ridiculed the Lakers a lot on our brief podcast history, but what's sad to me about their team this year is I think if they had surrounded LeBron on the Lakers with the right players, this could have been such a fun team, where you could have evolved into sort of like this big man LeBron. He's legitimately going to be one of the best big men in the league over the next couple of years because of the ways like the Monroes and the Al Jeffersons are unplayable. And if like you had been able to surround, you know, older 34, 35 year old LeBron with a bunch of shooters so he can just post up like he did those couple of years in Miami, that would have been pretty awesome and pretty fun to watch. But, you know, they have surrounded him with just a complete lack of space. Maybe if they maybe this will just be a 1 year experiment like we've talked about, and they'll get rid of the Lance Stevensons of the world. But I think this Lakers team could have been really fun. Maybe it will be if they just go totally LeBron and the young guys and still try to shoot. But yeah, I think like next year, like LeBron could easily be the best five in the league.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thought. And I mean, like you were kind of hinting at, they have the guys even on this roster to kind of do that. Like if they just go heavy on Pope and Josh Hart and Kuzma and Ingram and whichever other shooter defendery types I'm forgetting about, they sort of have enough to cobble something like that together. But yeah, I mean, they probably didn't sign all these other veterans to just sit around. So
yeah,
does not look like that's the direction they're going. Although LeBron is big man, you know, there's no way JaVale and Zubac are playing 48 minutes,
yeah,
like ever. And I don't even think they have any, like, who's like even a regular four on their team? Like, I feel like they have two fives in Zubac and JaVale who are not going to play more than 15 minutes each. And then they have like a bunch of small ball fours like Kuzma, Ingram, LeBron. Unless I'm forgetting someone, they might actually be planning like 20 minutes a game of LeBron, kind of like the co-center with Ingram or Kuzma or something.
Would you say that LeBron is like full on a four at this point in his career?
I don't know.
Because people,
I mean, I guess positionless basketball, we can't define it anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because there's always been that old adage of like, as players get older, they slide up one position. Like Duncan went from the 4 to the 5. You know, you see like certain guards go from the 1 to the 2 as time goes on. And I'm like, if LeBron is fully a 4 and he does play as long as like it looks like he might be able to into his 40s, do we ever see him like fully become a 5? Like, that'd be pretty interesting if one day we see LeBron be all first team NBA and he's like the center spot. So,
yeah, I mean, that seems possible. I mean, I definitely think that LeBron's perimeter defense is not as good as his help defense anymore. I don't think that, I mean, in practice, he didn't guard a good perimeter player basically ever in the playoffs last year.
Yeah.
What, I guess he was occasionally matched up on KD when he was forced to in the finals, but that was only because the Warriors didn't have a bad perimeter player for him to guard.
Yeah, I got us a little off track. What was next in your questions for the future?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think like it's pretty open-ended. It's just kind of like, I don't know. This is kind of where we are. And then we've described all these zigs and zags and responses and counters. And so we don't really know what's coming next.
But, I like your...
we're just kind of guessing at it.
As a fan of the 2019 Spurs, I like your question of, will we see a return of the mid-range jumper if the layups and three strategy becomes too predictable in the playoffs? I guess that's what the Spurs are going for, but who knows?
I mean, we saw a little of that with the Rockets. I feel like that was a lot of what Chris Paul added to their team, was a guy who can kind of get his own mid-range jumper when the offense bogs down, which they kind of didn't have the previous season. And the Spurs, I mean, we've been over this on the podcast before, but like the Spurs kind of were able to shut down the Rockets partially by just guarding the rim and the three-point line and knowing that that was the only places they had to contest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's also, you know, we could see some more rule changes. Who knows? They already, I think they implemented one rule change. I don't think it's a big deal this offseason, where the 24-second shot clock only resets to 14 on offensive rebounds now. They took that one from the WNBA, actually. But I don't know. There's, yeah, rule changes could throw curveballs. Like you were saying, one generational player and then a bunch of copycats like Steph Curry or, you know, guys that do things that previously were not common could change things. We don't know.
Yeah.
Basically, I think we should just leave it open-ended. We can't predict the future, but it's kind of an interesting, I feel like we're at the cusp of another turn in some direction, because right now, only a few of the teams and disproportionately the successful teams are following like real positionless switch everything kind of defense. And I feel like either more teams are going to go that way or we're going to figure out that actually like very few teams are ever going to have the personnel to do that. So who knows, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, maybe there's just going to be no non-shooters in the NBA. Like all the centers can handle and shoot. All the point guards can handle and shoot. Everyone can guard everyone. There's nobody who's slow and there's nobody who's under 6'3", because it's just everyone is switch everything. Everyone's a shooter. Everyone's a ball handler because everyone else just got played off the court or played out of the league.
One thing
that seems like possible.
One thing that I don't like about the NBA when these strategy shifts come is like you see all these bad imitations of, you know, teams trying to play like a couple years ago after the Spurs won and the Warriors won their first title. There were all these teams throughout the NBA who were doing really cheap imitations of pace and space. And then now, like the last year, I remember like the Hawks, this is the example I always go back to, but we're trying to make like Dwayne Dedman shoot threes, and we're, he's not a very good 3-point shooter, and their offense and their team is just so garbage. Like, and he's one of their most athletic players. Put him down low, let him catch lobs, let him rim run instead of like posting him up in the corner. And I just feel like you see a lot of these bad imitations. And what I would prefer to happen is for the NBA to look more like college basketball or almost more like the English Premier League. In soccer, to where like the bad lower table teams in the English Premier League in soccer, you know, they have their own distinct style because that they know that that's the only way that they can beat the bigger teams. And so it's like, I wish like you know, you'd have certain teams that, like, in the NBA, like, say the Magic, they're like, hey, we know we're not going to win if we switch everything, so let's just play, like, really weird, like, kind of strange basketball. I don't know what that would be, but, like, an example I think of is, like, the total example of zagging or the grit and grind Grizzlies of just, like, we're going to ugly everything up. And even the Cavs, when they beat the Warriors a couple years ago, they were like, we're just going to completely ugly up the game. And I think, like, that would be interesting, and maybe it would make for less aesthetically pleasing basketball, but I would rather worse teams just adopt their own style of play more so than trying to be, like, crappy imitations of the good teams and just clanking, you know, just all sorts of open threes every night. So
I semi disagree. I kind of feel like every, like, the four teams that made the conference finals last year, and even the teams that closely missed, basically all had similar looking styles. And I think that's because that style is just better. So I think, like, if you can find a quirky way to act, I guess what I'm saying is, maybe in theory I agree with you, but in practice it seems like the good teams identify good strategies and copying them is the way to eventually become good.
Yeah, if you, I agree, if you have the right personnel, but, like, a lot of these bad teams, like, they draft the wrong personnel and then they try to make those guys be some people, you know, someone that they're not. And maybe, like, you,
I guess I just think the bad teams have players who are not good.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's, like, a strategy, a different strategy that would make them better.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, the Premier League analogy. It's like, you know, West Brom, they actually got relegated last year. They're just the first people that came to mind. They don't have as good of players as Manchester City do. So they, in order to do that, they have to cover up their weaknesses by playing a more defensive first, like, strategy in order to, like, heighten those guys' strengths and hide their weaknesses. And yeah, I like positionless basketball. I like pace and space, like we saw in the conference finals this year, when the right teams are doing it because they have good players. But, like, I just think it's depressing to watch the Hawks or the Magic, like, just miss or take 50 threes a night and miss most of them. So if they have athletic players, I would rather them see them maximize those players' strengths as opposed to, like, make somebody like Jonathan Simmons shoot 9 threes a game. It's like, Jonathan Simmons, yeah, it's probably not that good and maybe not, doesn't have a place on a contender, but, like, is super athletic. So let Jonathan Simmons do, like, the couple things that he's good at.
So I kind of think the Premier League is not the right analogy for how NBA teams should optimize, because in my limited understanding of the Premier League, the marquee teams kind of always have the marquee players, and the lower tier teams are kind of perpetually have lower tier players because of the way it's structured.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, in the NBA, the bad teams get the top picks. And so, like, every 5 years, you know, like, obviously today the example would be, like, the Sixers or even, I guess, the Celtics or something. Like, the star players are on teams that didn't have star players 5 years ago. And so it seems like the way to be when you're bad, maybe your strategy would maximize, like, number of wins in a bad, although I don't even really think I agree with that, because I think threes increase variance the most, and the best way for a bad team to beat a good team is to shoot 50 threes, because, like, you never know. You'll have, like, one night. It's just a lot more variance, obviously, when there's one more point per shot. But, like, suppose your strategy, it seems like the best case for your strategy might be to maximize present day wins, but I would argue at the cost of building towards being good one day, because basically what I'm saying is, like, if you need to have one of these team strategies to be elite, then you want to mold your roster and your players towards getting better at the type of basketball that they'll eventually need to be elite, even if that doesn't maximize, like, their wins in the tanking years or whatever.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I would say, I don't think that three-point shooting is that immutable of a skill. I think there's a lot of guys who are, like, pretty good three-point shooters who were not very good three-point shooters or never shot threes for a long time. And so in some sense, I think teams are finding a ton of value by making these random dudes like Dwayne Dedmon shoot threes, because you never know when you're going to find a guy who like suddenly becomes really good at threes, and then you have like a really useful player or like a really useful trade chip. And I'm not coming up with, we didn't talk about this beforehand, so I don't have any great examples off the top of my head, but well, I guess the Spurs have a ton of guys who their magical shooting coach taught how to shoot threes.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it's happened like around the league where guys like Pascal Siakam couldn't shoot anything when he came into the league. And now, like, I think part of his value is that he's a spectacular athlete who can also shoot threes. And in my view, is like a tremendously useful role player because of that.
So I guess I agree with you. My strategy from like a night to night, just like making the individual games on when like the Magic and Hawks are playing one another, maybe that makes it a little bit more watchable in the short term, watching a random game in November, December, but probably doesn't lead to those like franchising, maximizing their long-term outlook. All right. That
seems like the right conclusion.
Last question that I wanted to ask you, and I didn't run this by you before, but Kevin O'Connor wrote an article for The Ringer about the lineups that he's daydreaming about going into the season. I wanted to see if you had a lineup just off the top of your head from a given team that you were super excited by.
Oh, yeah. So I think for me, the really obvious answer here is the Raptors answer to the death lineup. So basically what I'm thinking of is Lowry at point guard, Danny Green at shooting guard, OG Anunoby, who in his second season last year transformed into a really high level 3-and-D kind of guy with a little bit of off the dribble game, Kawhi, hopefully healthy Kawhi, out there with Anunoby on the wing, and then Pascal Siakam as the small ball center who can who's absolutely athletic enough to switch and guard point guards. I think those five can pretty much, they can all shoot, they can all handle at least a little bit. They have one superstar on offense, one like kind of tier two superstar. I would argue Lowry is like a borderline top 12, top 14 player. You know, I've always been high on Lowry. I think that's the kind of lineup. Honestly, you put Lowry on Steph, Lowry's always gotten a little bit of traction against Steph on defense relative to other guys. Kawhi's the best KD defender in the league. Danny Green's the best Klay defender in the league. And Siakam is kind of like a Draymond Jr. in terms of his play style and like athleticism. And Anunoby's just like, you know, a younger, obviously not the same superstar or star kind of talent, but like a younger version of Iguodala in terms of what he does on the court, probably a better shooter and like less length and athleticism on D. So I actually think that this Raptors lineup, if everything clicks, if they find the right cohesion together, if they gel, if Kawhi really is that best player in the league, quality player that he was 2 years ago, I think that Lowry, Green, Anunoby, Kawhi and Pascal Siakam could be closing finals games in Canada next June and potentially bringing home a world shocking title over the Warriors. And it would be equally shocking, I think, to people if they beat the Celtics, who obviously came 10 points away from making the NBA finals without their two best players last year and are similarly stacked with positionless shooter defender types. But yeah, that's my lineup I'm daydreaming about seeing this season, just because it's a lineup we haven't seen before that I think the sky is really the limit.
Okay, you stole mine, so I'll go with the, and that's,
oh my gosh, you had the same one?
Yeah, so I'll go with the,
that's crazy. We didn't even talk about this.
I'll go with the reality show lineup then from an entertainment standpoint. Rondo, Lance, KCP, LeBron, and JaVale. Oh, no. Instead of Casey
Beasley.
Yeah, instead of KCP, Michael Beasley. So, yeah.
Wow, that literally would have been my other choice. Oh my gosh, we're developing some sort of podcast mind meld.
I like it. Yeah. Did you have anything else? Yeah.
Did you want to touch on
Luol Deng anymore? So.
Just a couple things. Not on the Timberwolves. The Cavs picked up David Nwaba for $1.5 million this year. Terrific defender. Really excellent pickup. And they re-signed Rodney Hood as a restricted free agent. I think he took the qualifying offer of $3.5 million. He'll be a free agent again next year. Which is a great price for a really solid role player. I know he had some struggles in the playoffs last year, but he's a good player. And so, yeah, the Cavs, like, scooping up some cheap pieces. Nwaba, of course, was on the Bulls last year, and they paid $20 million to Zach LaVine instead of $1.5 million to a guy who's been better than LaVine every year, basically, in the NBA. Obviously, they're really different players, but you could argue that the Bulls need the defense of Nwaba even more than the scoring of LaVine. So a real bummer, in my view, to see them let Nwaba go like that. But yeah, the Cavs, it just really comes down to Colin Sexton, because due to LeBron's presence and having the ball most of the time, the Cavs never really invested in getting any playmakers or any guys who can create for others. So they're kind of missing off the ball creation on their roster, up and down the roster. But other than that, with some of these cheap signings they're making, I think the Cavs, you could see them, if Sexton, also, I don't really think Sexton's very good, just because I think he's not a very good shooter, and I don't think he's quite explosive enough to make up for how far off him teams are going to play in the NBA. Like, much like Dennis Smith last year, I think he's going to underwhelm a little bit, at least in my view. But like, if Sexton is better than I think he is, I could see the Cavs competing for an 8 seed with the way they're filling out the back of their roster. And then on the Timberwolves, yeah, I mean, I think people, when you look at the lineup data, all combinations of the Timberwolves starters basically had elite net ratings last year. Like, with Jimmy on the court, they were plus 8.3 per 100, which is like, you know, 3 seed range for sure. And of course, they were the 3 seed when he got hurt. And with Jimmy and Towns together, there was something like, I haven't looked this up in a while, but there was something like plus 12 per 100. And basically, like, the reason they weren't good was, or the reason they weren't as good was because Jimmy missed a third of the season and they were just flaming hot garbage with any combination of players alongside Jamal Crawford.
Do you think them hating each other had something to do with it?
I think that's like a BS story, first of all. Second of all, I don't, like, everyone loved Jamal Crawford, and he's literally the only thing in the lineup data that sticks out as a sore thumb. Like, all the lineups, you switch out Crawford for one of the players, and they're bad. And you take Crawford out, and, like, basically any combination of their other seven top guys was, like, a top five team in the NBA in their minutes together. And so, really, the key, so Crawford's gone, so that's good for the Timberwolves. But really, just the key is just getting some competent minutes when Jimmy's out of the game and when Towns is out of the game. And I think that the Walt Dang is like exactly what they needed. He's like a 10th man on their team. He won't be expected to do much, but he's going to guard. He's going to play team offense. He's going to hit open shots. And that's what they need. And also, Tolliver, I think, is a really underrated bench player. Very good shooter, very good defender. He's kind of like Taj Gibson plus a jumper. Not as good, obviously, at the things Gibson does, but does similar kinds of things. And so, yeah, I think the Timberwolves, people forget that the best five-man lineup in the NBA last year with, like, at least a 200-minute sample or something was Tyus Jones for Teague and the other four Timberwolves starters. And basically, the Timberwolves were really good in all the minutes that their top guys were playing. So they can cover these holes in their rotation a little bit better this year. In addition to Dang, the one thing I really like is that they have some options. So Dang might not be the guy who wins that job, that backup wing job, but they have Dang, they have CJ Williams, they have James Nunnally, who had a spectacular season in the Euro League last year, shot over 50% from three, and then they have their rookie, Josh Okogie. So they basically have four guys who they just need one of them to be competent as a backup wing, and I think that if they get that, I think they contend for the 2 seed and are like a strong contender for the 3 seed. But we'll see. They have to stay healthy. I mean, in my view, after the Warriors and probably the Rockets, depending how much Carmelo makes them worse, there's like 4 or 5 teams where I just think the healthiest one of them is going to be the 3 seed. And that's basically like Thunder, Jazz, Timberwolves, Nuggets, and maybe the Pelicans and Spurs.
Gosh, I would be absolutely shocked if the Timberwolves were the 3 seed.
They were the 3 seed until March last year.
I don't know, they
finished 1 win out of the 3 seed. You know, if they'd beaten the Trailblazers, they would have been in a 6-way tie from 3 to 8, and they played the Trailblazers twice without Jimmy in February and March. If they'd won one of those games, they would have been in a 6-way tie, and they held the tiebreaker because they basically beat the snot out of those other six teams.
Yeah, I mean, I like Jimmy. I like Cat. I actually like Andrew Wiggins. I think he gets really unfairly hated on. I like them all as individual.
He was so terrible last year.
I like them all as individual players, but I just like every time I've watched them, I don't know. I just felt like something doesn't click. Maybe it's just more of the eye test than anything else. And I don't know. I'm not super high on, you know, the bench guys maybe that you mentioned. I mean, do you think Jimmy...
Tyus is awesome.
Do you think Jimmy...
Gorgie struggled last year, but has had some times when he's a really solid NBA player, and Tolliver's a really good player. They need some of the wings to click.
Yeah. Do you think Jimmy is on the T-Wolves going into next season?
I think it just depends whether I'm right or you're right about this upcoming season. I think if the Timberwolves win a series, there's no chance Jimmy leaves if they make the conference semifinals, which I think probably they have like a 60% chance of doing. But I think if they finish like without home court advantage and lose in the first round, then there's probably like a 50% chance he stays.
If they don't win a series and the Raptors are really successful in the East, I would say 95% he's gone and he's going to LA. And he's LeBron.
Wait.
He's LeBron's running mate. Because if the Raptors are successful to where Kawhi wants to stay in Toronto, the Wolves aren't successful, the Lakers are still going to need that second fiddle. And I would maybe like someone like Jimmy Butler with LeBron on the Lakers, maybe even better than I would like Kawhi on the Lakers. I think there's part of me that still just doesn't want to see Kawhi wearing a Lakers jersey, but yeah.
I mean, like, we just don't know how healthy Kawhi is.
Well, he's now all of a sudden found it in his heart to be able to build relationships with other NBA players and play pickup basketball games with KD and LeBron, something he never did his 7 years in San Antonio, which I love Kawhi on the court, but he remains a baffling human being. Like, you know, part of the reason that the Spurs maybe have not been able to recruit free agents, which is kind of a fallacy in its own right. We've really batted 500. We got LaMarcus Aldridge. We didn't get Kevin Durant. Those are the only two people we've really been in conversations to actually have a chance at. But Kawhi never built relationships with other NBA stars. He really, until this summer, had no reported relationship with LeBron. KD sort of has always dismissed Kawhi. And I think he's sort of always been looked at as like a redheaded stepchild or a little brother by the other NBA superstars, which is their fault for being ignorant, not realizing how great he is. But also, you have to, as a superstar, there is that marketing aspect where you have to promote yourself and you have to get yourself out there. And, you know, it just, that's fine if he didn't want to be the Spurs ambassador and the, you know, the next person to carry the mantle of the Spurs. I actually think he did up until, you know, about 6 months ago. But, oh well, I just think it's frustrating that all of a sudden now he is playing pickup basketball games with LeBron and KD, where, you know, I remember last summer Bill Simmons doing a podcast talking about these like underground games in LA and wondering why Kawhi was never there. But like, he actually was like, man, DeMar DeRozan is at all these games. And like, DeMar DeRozan has great relationships with other players in the league. But like, it's sort of weird that Kawhi is like second, third best player in the league, maybe on a given night the best, but he has no relationship with these other NBA players, has always walked on USA Basketball. So yeah,
how wild is it that you're a Spurs fan and they've like won 5 titles in the last 20 years, and also you're more bitter than me? You're just like so bitter right now, like we weren't even talking about Kawhi and he just went on like a 7-minute rant about how angry you are that you didn't recruit free agents in the past, and I'm like a fan of this trash fest organization. I'm just kind of like sitting here meditating in peace.
I forgot. I guess I didn't talk about it 2 weeks ago, whenever that picture came out, because I texted you and I was just so pissed about him working out with LeBron and KD that I hadn't gotten to rant about it yet. All that being said,
so like all podcasts, we finished this podcast with you talking about Kawhi and me talking about Jimmy and Luol.
Yeah, I like it.
Back to our same place.
Yeah. All that being said, I still have my Kawhi Leonard poster up in my office.
Look at that big heart.
Yeah, in my house.
Forgiving soul. Yeah.
And I, like I said, I'm really pumped about the Raptors this year. I'm just trying to look at it totally from a basketball perspective. Kawhi Leonard is really my favorite basketball player that I've ever watched play. And I'm trying to take the emotional side out of it. I just purely love watching him play the sport. So, yeah, we'll end at that note. I could probably talk about that for a little while longer. But next week, we're going to do our 5 league pass teams. We can't include our favorite teams in those. So that should be a fun discussion. Hit us up on Twitter. Let us know who your league pass teams for the season would be. At Takes of the Game is our Twitter handle. You can subscribe to the podcast. Tell your friends. It's on the Third String podcast feed. We've combined all of our podcasts on a one feed now. Football, basketball, this is Takes of the Game, and baseball. You can hear Eshawn on. You bat for the cycle pretty consistently. You're on all 3 podcasts occasionally. So.
Oh, yeah, sometimes. And you can follow us on Twitter. Taylor is at TheTYoung. And my new Twitter handle is at Jimmy Lou and Taj.
Oh, my God.
The Twitter account is called Jimmy and Lou Forever.
Nice.
It's got an adorable picture of Jimmy and Lou all laughing together on the 2011 Bulls.
Yeah, I like it. Well, I am feeling the NFL fever right now. I'm actually excited about it for the first time in several years. So maybe Zach will invite me on one of the football podcasts soon. But that's all for Takes of the Game this week. Eshawn.
I can do any podcast except college football because I'm too emotional about it.
Oh my gosh. Don't even get me started about the Longhorns right now and Tom Herman. I am more mad at him than I am at Kawhi. So.
All right. We should cut this off. Neither of us should get started.
I'll talk to you next week.